Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Don Crowley, acclaimed author, speaker, and international authority in Linux and Cisco. Don, I'm just looking at your background. You've done a lot. So thank you for coming in today to share your work and experiences with our audience.
Stephen, thank you for the invitation. I'm honored.
Now, Don, I think you sometimes profess yourself as a geek. So can you profile your background?
Yeah, my background is diverse. Thank you for asking about that. I guess if I were to discuss being a geek, it would go back to when I was 12 years old and I decided to rewire a tape recorder. Not sure why I thought it needed to be rewired, but I did. And so I rewired it, plugged it in, flame shot out, and I set my bedroom on fire. And ever since then, I've been tinkering with different systems, ranging from audio systems to automation systems to computer systems, and most recently various aspects of networking. Although I didn't receive formal training in that field, ultimately I did end up going for certifications in both Cisco and Linux, and several years ago in Windows, although I don't really work in the Windows space anymore.
So Don, what 5 usable lessons can you share from your remarkable career history?
5 usable lessons. Number 1 is it's not about technology. It's about creating solutions for workplace problems. And although we use technology to do that, the most important thing that we have to remember as technologists is that the technology is merely the vehicle that we use to do that, and that really it's about humans and helping our end users work more productively, creatively, and efficiently. So that's the most important lesson in terms of what I do and the people I work with. Number 2 is to not be afraid to experiment. And so I think it's very, very important to have a sandbox. And in working with a lot of beginning IT professionals, what I see is that they don't have a place where they can experiment and explore and break things without having the pressure of lost productivity. So very important to have a sandbox. Number 3 is that none of us know nearly as much as we think we know. So about the time that I become convinced that I understand how something works, I see another side to it. And number 4, kind of tagging on number 3, is that there are usually multiple ways to get something done. So just as in life, the same thing applies to technology. And just the fact that one person does it in a particular way doesn't necessarily mean that that's right or wrong. It just means that that's a different way of doing things. How many do I have? Have I done 4 now?
Yeah, you've done a number. So
is that enough?
No, well, if you have 1 or 2 more, I'd be happy.
Yeah, well, here's another one. I'm going to rant for a second, but Mac, Windows, Linux, Unix, doesn't really matter. What matters is what does the job. And we can argue about whether, Mac is easier to use, Linux is more stable, or whether Windows is more secure or less secure. And the reality is that if you look at study after study, various systems are as secure as their operators make them, and various systems are as easy to use as their users try to understand them. And while Stephen Jobs probably wins the award for understanding usability and ease of use, the reality is that Windows can be pretty easy to use, and Linux can, and it's really just a matter of finding the right tool for the job. It's kind of like the Ford versus Chevrolet argument, we could go around and around on that, but it doesn't really matter. What matters is what's the right tool for the job.
Now, you've got this great background also with Cisco, so can you share your best practices for using Cisco technologies?
Best practice for using Cisco technology, first and foremost, is get trained. And you'd probably expect that coming from a trainer and an author. I base that on the fact that I've had many, many students come into entry-level classes thinking they knew more than they did and messing up configuration. And Cisco, just as with any system, is getting more and more complex and requires more in-depth understanding. So best practice for dealing not only with Cisco but with Linux is to get trained and then to always have a backup. And here's a little thing, but kind of a basic thing. I've had many students come to my classes because they wanted to fire their consultants, and many of the times they wanted to fire their consultants were because consultants didn't save configuration. So it's pretty fundamental that when you're working working with a Cisco device, whether it's a router or a firewall or a switch, get it working the way you want it, and then make sure and save your configuration and make sure you do a backup beforehand. I guess that would apply to pretty much anything, though, wouldn't it? Not just Cisco.
Yes, absolutely. Now, you're also an acclaimed author, and you've spent a considerable amount of your time sort of capturing all of your life's experiences, your work history, sort of the best practices in writing these books. Can you then profile your latest book?
My latest book is called Tweeting Linux, and it was kind of a kind of grew out of a whim. I had attended a workshop by a guy named Kevin Eikenberry on leadership, and he had captured a series of tweets that he'd done and put them together in a book. And I'm not a regular tweeter, although I have a tweeting account under the Twitter name Sound Training. But I thought, what a great idea to force yourself to capture nuggets of wisdom in 140 characters less. And I began to wonder, could I do that with commands that are used in Linux? And so what I did was I thought, okay, I'm going to force myself to edit to the extreme and to explain the most commonly used Linux commands in 140 characters. And I thought, well, what are the most commonly used commands? I thought, well, let's just continue that 140 theme. So it was the 140 Linux commands explained in 140 characters or less. And I actually got it done. What I found, though, was that in addition to the 140 characters, I needed to include a screen capture, and some of them just simply required more detail. But by forcing myself as an author to think efficiently and to think precisely, I was able to come up with explanations for Linux commands in 140 characters or less. The benefit, I think, to the reader, and I really just judge that based on what would be a benefit to me as a reader, but is that it seems like a lot of the documentation for Linux stuff is very detailed and goes into great depth, and maybe all I need to know is just, what does this command do? I don't need to know all of the aspects of it. I just need to know what it does. Then I can make a decision as to whether or not I want to learn more about it. And so that was what I strove for, and I'll let you be the judge as to whether I achieved it or not with Tweeting Linux. But it was a fun project, and it was a shorter project than most of the other books. This one probably took about 3 months to write.
Well, that's kind of remarkable. You know, your shorter book project is 3 months. So what's the typical length of a longer book project?
I was afraid you were going to ask that. I do about 2 books a year, so that would seem like that would work out to about 6 months. But the challenge, any author who's written a book like this will tell you that it's a lengthy process. The challenge for a lot of people, if they're starting a book from scratch, is doing all the research. And I've already done a lot of the research for the training that I do. So I say it takes me 6 months to write a book, but that's using a lot of existing research and a lot of existing how-to guides that I've already done. I would guess that if somebody were to start a book like one of mine, my books are not terribly long. You know, they're 200 to 300 pages. But if you were to start something like that from scratch, it'd probably take you a year to a year and a half to do for most authors, and for me too, if I were starting from scratch.
Now, getting back to this, your book on Linux, was there one command you discovered while researching the book that you really found especially helpful?
You'd submitted that earlier, and I thought about that, there were an awful lot that I found helpful. The one that kept coming to my mind was one that I didn't know before, that I have since found very helpful, and that's the MTR command, which is kind of combining ping and traceroute, similar to path ping in Windows. And I still find that one very helpful, and I was kind of surprised that I didn't know it. That was really the only command when I was researching Tweeting Linux that I found that I didn't know, and I'm not even sure how I ran across that, although, you know, sometimes you just do that in the process of researching. So that was probably the one that kept coming to the forefront of my mind more than others as I was thinking about your question.
Now, what's a common mistake admins make when working in a Linux command line environment?
Probably the most common mistake that I can't speak for other admins, but the most common mistake that I've made is in not making a backup of a configuration file before I start editing it. So I think that's probably one of the most common things that I've seen students do, and certainly that I've done, is I'll be hot on the trail of a problem, and I'll start troubleshooting, and I'll narrow it down to a particular configuration file, and I'll start editing it before I've made a backup of the file. And that seems so obvious, and it's kind of embarrassing to admit, but you know, I've been working with Linux for years, and I still catch myself doing that occasionally. And then I have to stop and, you know, go back and make the backup.
Why work in the command line when graphical interfaces have gotten so much better and they're so much easier?
Oh, that's an easy question. Thank you for asking that, because that's a question that comes up an awful lot. And the answer is twofold. One is because mainly on a server, you don't work with a GUI. You know, I maintain several websites, and they're all hosted on Linux servers, and not a one of them has a GUI installed, and why would you put a GUI on it? Secondly, it's a lot less overhead. Thirdly, kind of tying in with the second comment, is it's one less thing to break. And you know, you've had kind of a theme in some of your questions, Stephen, about common mistakes that people make, and I think another common mistake kind of tied in with the GUI is installing things, more services, more daemons on your system than you need, and having things there that you're not using, which are more things to break, more things to create security vulnerabilities, and just more problems, potential problems to have. So you know, that's another reason. And finally, is scripting. It's a lot easier to script in the command line environment than to do it in the GUI, and especially if you don't have a GUI. So I, you know, it depends on the system. I don't think I would want to work with a desktop system running PC DOS anymore, any more than I would want to use VI as my word processor, although I like to joke about it being my favorite word processor. But the reality is that on a desktop or a laptop system, you want a GUI. But certainly on a server, I don't think that's necessary. And Microsoft even recognizes that with Server 2008 offering a command line environment only version, which makes sense.
Now, you gave a common mistake admins make. Can you think of any others when working in the Linux command line environment?
Common mistakes others than doing backup? Well, I think I just mentioned one, and that is having services running that you don't need. That's kind of security 101, part of hardening a system, is eliminating any services or daemons that are not necessary. And I think when we're first learning systems, we don't take the time to understand what each of the different processes does. And if you do a PSAUX on a Linux system and take a look at all of your running processes, I'll bet you most of us don't know what all of them are. And, you know, honestly, I'm probably guilty of that too.
Now, your book includes some material for desktop and laptop users, but it seems more oriented towards server admins. Is Linux still relevant as a desktop or laptop operating system?
Oh, you're asking a dangerous question, Stephen. That's a dangerous question to ask. And the reason is because, going back to the Ford and Chevy argument, there are people who are devotees of Ubuntu or Mint as a desktop operating system, or even, you know, Fedora or various flavors of Red Hat, or even Debian. And, you know, you get into people who are pretty serious technologists, you'll find people who are running Slackware on their laptop as their desktop or laptop operating system. So that's a difficult and a dangerous question to answer. I think it's relevant if that's something that you want to do. I recently did a training project for a nonprofit organization in Omaha, and they use Ubuntu Linux throughout the entire operation. They're using that along with LibreOffice, and doing so quite successfully. So, you know, the arguments about Linux or Ubuntu not being applicable or relevant as a desktop operating system, I don't think hold water. But the arguments about interoperability between a world that is based on Windows and a small percentage of systems running Linux, I think, introduces some of the challenges that people using Linux face. You know, it's difficult dealing with the Microsoft proprietary document formats, the DOCX, for example. But it can be done, you know, if you're willing to make the effort. So I think it is relevant. I think it's important. Will it ever gain huge market share at this point, it looks like it probably won't, but, you know, who knows what the future holds.
Now, why is there a need for another Linux command reference?
Well, I, you know, I'm an author. I have a need to write. But beyond focusing on me, I think it goes back to what we talked about earlier. In my experience, a lot of the Linux command references, although technically competent, I mean, I have a bookshelf full of them, they don't do a good job of summarizing the commands. And I think that's the one piece that I brought to the mix that that the others didn't, was my ability to summarize the commands in very, very concise terms. So somebody who is just learning Linux can actually sit down and gain an understanding fairly quickly.
I see. So that's the differentiator in your book.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of been a theme that I've worked, and it's an accidental theme. I mean, I've written two books that are titled The Accidental Administrator, one for Cisco ASAs and one for Linux servers, and my theme has been, I didn't intend it this way, but it's turned out to be that this is a way that you can quickly learn Linux commands or Cisco commands and get up to speed quickly. Do you gain in-depth knowledge? Not so much, but you know, IT people tend to be really, really smart and perfectly capable of doing research on our own to figure stuff out. What we often need is just a starting point. And I think that's what my books strive to do. And again, I'll let you be the judge as to whether they achieve that or not.
I guess it goes back to sort of the Pareto principle of 80-20, kind of the 80% you really don't need that often.
Well, right, yeah. I remember when I was first beginning to teach technology classes, and I was intimidated by my students because they all knew a whole lot more than I did, or do. I thought, oh my gosh, you know, they're gonna get up and walk out. But what I began to realize is that I had little bits of pieces of information that they didn't, and that's what they were there for. They weren't there to master the universe. They were there to master a couple of particular techniques, and if I gave them that, then that met their goal. And then I began to realize that nobody, you know, I mean, whether it's Richard Stallman or Bill Gates or Steve Jobs or Linus Torvalds, nobody knows it all. And what we are is a collective. The world is a collective of people who each of us individually knows a certain portion of the available knowledge in the world, but collectively we do know it all. And what we need to know is, first of all, a starting point, and secondly, where can we go to get the pieces of information that we don't have that we need? And that's what I strive to do as an educator, is help people get a starting point and then empower them to figure out how to solve problems on their own out in the field.
Well, I'm really now interested in those really kind of flaming hot points in the areas that you work in, you know, the ones that are really controversial or there's a lot of discussion and a lot of going back and forth. Now, can you describe three of them?
The hot points in technology. Sure. One is the Linux versus Windows versus Mac debate. I would say just this is anecdotal. I haven't looked at any statistics lately, but it seems like Linux and Windows are fighting it out on the server side, and Windows and Macs are fighting it out on the desktop side. And I don't know who's winning. I guess Windows is winning in the desktop wars. I'm not sure who's winning in the server wars, but you know, it seems like what that really boils down to more than anything is, what do you know best? And so if you happen to know Windows better, then that's what you choose. If you happen to know Linux better, then that's what you choose. I'd say that's one of the hot points. Another one is something that is emerging right now, and that's the cloud computing. And for years, those of us in IT have seen that coming, and we've been participating in it and supporting it to a very various extents. But we've always had concerns about who owns the data, and the security of the data, and the availability of the data. And so, you know, those three issues related to cloud computing have been discussion points. I don't know if you'd call them hot points or not, but they've certainly been discussion points for a long time, and that continues to this day. And I think then the third issue, you said three, so the third issue is privacy. You know, Google has done a great job. I'm going to pick on Google, but they're certainly not the only ones who are doing this. Facebook and pretty much all of the search engines and the social media providers do this, but they do a great job of providing functionality. In exchange, they data mine us, and I mean that's how they make money, by understanding what we like, our interests, and then targeting advertising to us. And for a lot of us in IT, that makes us very nervous, and it should. I think that there's a I'm going to get on a bit of a soapbox, but I think there's some blind acceptance of that by the populace, I think that's a dangerous thing. I just finished rereading 1984. A few weeks ago, and I hadn't read it since probably high school, but I thought the time was right to read it again, and I just see an awful lot of blind acceptance, kind of along the same lines as what happened in Orwell's 1984, of people not questioning the authority and just accepting what they're told and not worrying about what's going on behind the scenes. So, I mean, you got me a little bit on a soapbox of politics, I guess, which is a dangerous place to go, but I think it's relevant to the privacy discussions. We need to be vigilant about that. The Stop Online Piracy Act is a scary act, in my opinion, it looks like it's going to become a reality for us. So there's just an awful lot of stuff going on at a pretty high level that is a hot point and is of a concern.
What innovation should we be watching for in the next 5 years?
I'm fascinated by mobile computing, I follow Gizmodo and Wired, so I love watching what's happening in the mobile space. I just bought my wife a Samsung Galaxy tablet for Christmas, and it's been hard for me to keep my hands off of it. So I think the portability of computing power is one of the most fascinating things to me. The portability combined with the decreasing size. I use an Android phone, and I love the fact that I can nearly run my business from my phone. Not quite. There's a couple of things still missing, but it's certainly heading that way.
Now, what specific challenges and opportunities should IT workers and businesses embrace today and into the future?
I think the challenges are remembering, going back to your first question and my answer, it's remembering that this is not about technology. This is about helping end users, whether they're in the workplace or personal, work more productively, creatively, and efficiently. So what we need to be thinking about is not creating cool gadgets, but creating cool solutions to workplace and personal problems and challenges. So as we think about what to do in the future, I think we need to be thinking about ease of use and look at what the Jakob Nielsen does, the work that he does in terms of usability. I'm still amazed by websites where I can't easily find information where I need training in order to use the website, which to me is unconscionable. I think about great websites that are easy to use where I find my way around them, and I just think that with our devices and all of the different systems that we work with, that's probably one of the most important things. I'm fascinated to see what Microsoft will come up with Windows 8 and whether they really will be able to extend usability across multiple platforms and across a tablet and a phone and a desktop and a laptop. And if they can do that, then they'll hit a grand slam home run. But the jury is way out on that. The jury hasn't even gone into deliberations on that yet.
Now, this question is sort of on a different vein, and that is, there's 31 million IT workers out there worldwide, and they're in different jobs and they're trying to find a career path, and they're many of them start their education in many other areas. Some of them get an education in the computing area, but there's kind of this idea of computing as a recognized profession. People who work in the finance industry, work in some of the more skills-based professions, they're recognized professions today, as is these more traditional ones like medicine, law, engineering, accounting, and so on. So what are your thoughts on computing as a recognized profession with demonstrated professional development adherence to a code of ethics recognized credential?
Well, I think that's here now. I mean, you look at the first of all, the degrees that are being offered in computer science. I just did a talk last week at the University of Washington in the electrical engineering building and accidentally walked into the computer science building, the Paul Allen computer science building, by mistake. And, I mean, it's a huge department at the University of Washington alone, and that's just one university out of however many there are. I think we're already there. I think it is already regarded as as a profession. It's a part of our lives. There was a politician a couple of years ago who was complaining about the county government's IT budget and how much it was growing. And this politician said, and the sad thing is that he was serious about it. He said, well, you know, we got along without computers beforehand. We'll just go back to those days now. And I'm thinking, you know, what planet are you on, dude? I mean, the computing industry and the profession are here to stay in one form or another. And so I think that what we're doing as an industry with things like ITIL and the computer certifications and the various degrees are solidifying that and working toward helping technologists understand the human aspects of it. I serve on an academic advisory committee at one of the community colleges, and part of their certification program for IT professionals, in addition to their degree program, is requirements that they take psychology and customer service classes in addition to the technology classes. And those are all things that we do to legitimize what we're doing. Maybe that's the wrong way, because I think the fact that it is there legitimizes it, but to add professional aspects to what we're doing.
You know, you do a lot of traveling. You're a recognized, internationally recognized, I should say, speaker, an authority, you know, from your books and from all the work that you do. Well, from all of this kind of traveling and work experience and speaking, are there some stories that you can share, you know, something maybe amusing or interesting, unexpected, and so on?
You know, I thought about that when I received the email from you earlier, because you mentioned that you were going to ask that, and I thought about the specific stories, I think of a couple. I don't know if they're amusing, but I want to share them anyway. One was, I was in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and I was teaching a Cisco ASA class, and I had tight connections, and I had to count on FedEx to pick up my case of firewalls at the hotel and get them to the next location. And I had a tight connection to go from the time the training ended to when I had to catch a train. I was going into New York City, and so I was kind of flustered. And I was on the phone while I was in the cab. I was on the phone with FedEx. And I wasn't, I hadn't done my homework. The gist of the story is that I kind of blew it. I blew it in a big way. I didn't do a good job of conveying the what I needed from FedEx. I got short. I don't think I lost my temper, but I certainly was tense. And ultimately, the package didn't get picked up as it was supposed to, and I was upset with FedEx. Well, I finally got the station phone number in Harrisburg, and I called and I talked to FedEx, and they said, well, we'd been out to pick it up and the hotel didn't know anything about it. Turned out that it was my fault for not appropriately labeling the package, and the hotel didn't realize what it was, and so on. And where I'm going with the story is that the FedEx manager at that particular station, after talking with me, got in his car himself and drove to the hotel and bird-dogged the problem until he found the package and got it to the destination in time. And that's just one of many, many stories of wonderful people doing wonderful human things that I look at and I think are way out of the ordinary, but they looked at it as just doing what they needed to do as one human helping out another human. And so I'm going to take advantage of this opportunity that you're giving me, Stephen, to say that I have had in millions of miles of travel, and I do have millions of miles of travel, I've had experience after experience after experience like that, and I've had very, 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 very few bad experiences. And what I've seen is, whether it's in Australia or the UK or in that amazing country to the north of the US called Canada, and yeah, that was a little suck up for you, but still, it's true, or throughout the US, that we are a global community of human beings helping other human beings. And when you take the labels away, when you take the religious or the political labels away, or the geopolitical labels away, that fundamentally we're just a bunch of really, really nice, decent people, who want to be nice, decent people to each other. And that's been the consistent theme that I've seen, in traveling all over the world and throughout the United States.
Okay. Well, you mentioned, another story. I think you earlier indicated two stories. So that's the one story. How about another one?
Let's see. Did I say that there were two?
Yeah. So I put you on the spot, maybe.
Let me think about it for a second. I was teaching an early, this isn't a great story, but it's a funny one that I think I mentioned this guy in one of my books. But I was teaching a class here in Seattle, and it was a Linux class, and it was one of the very first Linux classes that I'd ever taught. So I had just been ramping up, on learning Linux, and I was a little nervous, and, I had a class full of students. There were probably 20, 25 students in the class. And we were working through an installation of one of the earlier Red Hat operating systems. And there was a guy in the class named No Gooey Louie. And that was how he described himself. And I remember he was a really, really nice guy, and he really knew Linux really well. And I'm thinking, what on earth is this guy going to take from the class? But I think he knew way more than I did about Linux, but I think he just wanted to attend a class and see if he could fill in some gaps in his knowledge. So that's one, was with learning to work with a guy named No Gooey Louie. And he'll probably hear this. And Louie, if you hear this, I speak of you fondly and with great respect to this day, and that was probably 10 or 15 years ago. The number two story, again, teaching a Linux class in Portland, Oregon. When I in the early days of teaching Linux, I always had the students install GAIN. And because, you know, maybe you'll finish a lab before another student, and so this is a chance for you to do something, just to entertain yourself. There was a game that Red Hat used to include in their distro called K-Sokoban, and it was the most addictive game that I've ever seen. And if I got started on it today, I'd lose a half a day before I'd whack myself on the head and say, okay, get productive again. But anyway, so I had the students install K-Sokoban, and this one student seemed to be just very, very busy all the time. Well, I went and looked, and he was playing K-Sokoban. So we got the installation done. He played K-Sokoban. He spent the entire 2 days of the workshop playing K-Sokoban. And at the end, I said, gosh, you know, did you get anything out of it? He said, yeah, I got to the boss. And he was happy that he'd spent 2 days and $1,000 US playing K-Sokoban in a Linux class. But you know, if that was what it took to make him happy, then more power to him.
Right. So, that'd be sort of reflected in the evaluation he did. He gave you 10 out of 10.
That's an interesting question, Stephen, because I went back and I looked at it. I thought, you know, one of the frustrations that you have as a trainer is if you get a poor evaluation on something like that. But he gave me all 10s and he was happy. So if he was happy, then I'm happy. I don't know how his boss would have felt about it, but that's between him and his boss.
Yes, exactly. Well, we're down to our last question, and this is kind of an open-ended one where I sort of reversed the tables here, and, you know, so far I've been asking the questions, but obviously I've missed some that I should have asked. So if you were conducting this interview, what three questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
That's a tough one. That's like when you go into the boss and for your evaluation, and the boss says, okay, evaluate yourself. And that's one of the reasons why I don't work for anybody. I just work for myself because I don't want to have to go through those things. You really hit a lot of them. I guess one question that I would have for somebody who does what I do is, what piece of advice would you give somebody who is thinking about getting into computing technology? Not somebody who's already in it, but somebody, let's say you're a high school student or a college student with an undeclared major, and what piece of advice would you give somebody like that? And so the answer would be that if you love technology, that's only part of the equation. The other part is the human aspect, and that you're going to have to learn how to get along in the workplace. And that's kind of been a theme that has run through the interview, but that's kind of a theme that runs through my life. I wrote a book called The Compassionate Geek, Mastering Customer Service for IT Professionals. It's all about that, and it's about working well with other people and understanding the psychology, the emotions, the way people think and act. And so that's probably one of the most important things that they can do. So that's question number one, is what advice would you give somebody who's thinking about getting into it? And I would say think about the human aspects as well as the technical aspects. Number two, we kind of touched on this, but I think it's an important point, and that is how do you maintain your skills in this exponentially increasing body of knowledge world that we live in? And the answer is a sandbox, whether it's using VMware or virtual PC or VirtualBox or any of the other virtualization environments. Set up a sandbox where you can play and experiment and break things and fix them and work through the certifications. And kind of tied with that is a lot of people say, are certifications worth it? And the answer is yes, they are, as long as you take them seriously and go through the serious preparation process to get certified. So when I talk about that, I'm not talking about just memorizing questions and doing rote memorization of answers. I'm talking about sitting down in your lab and working through exercises, going to the Cisco website or the Windows, Microsoft website, and doing their labs, finding labs online for Linux, and trying things and really exploring and gaining the knowledge and mastering it, so that when you go in and take the test, you're not just spewing out answers, you're actually thinking through solutions. And I'll give you an example of that. The most recent test that I took for certification was the Cisco CCNA Security, and I prepped for that for 6 months before I went and took it. And when I took it, almost none of the questions were familiar to me. But what I found was that the circumstances were familiar, if that makes sense. So I was able to think through the problems that they presented and come up with solutions based on my existing body of knowledge. Had I simply memorized questions and answers, I wouldn't have been able to pass the test. But by working through things and really understanding how things work, how the technology worked and the environment in which it was being applied, I was able to infer correct answers to the questions on the exam, and I passed with a pretty high score. So I think to go back to the question about how do you maintain your skill set, you work towards certifications, you take them very, very seriously, and you don't simply do rote memorization. You gain a deeper understanding of the technology and how it works. So that's number two. And number three is, how do you deal with people who want free advice or free support? What I finally come up with, and I've been trying to figure this out for a long time, is there's some people that you just do that for. You help them. Your parents, your sibling, your kids, a couple of really, really close friends. Although your really, really close friends tend to respect you and don't ask that except in an emergency. So it's neighbors that you may not be particularly close to that will do that sort of thing. Or just, somebody else, who puts you in the same position as a doctor, saying, oh, you're a doctor. Well, let me tell you about my problem. And I what I've started saying is, in as gently a way as I can, is that I simply don't do that. And I'll be happy to refer you to Geek Squad or Staples Technical Support or someplace like that. And and that I've found that those places provide excellent support, but that's just not something that I'm able to do. And I learned from my friend and author Merrill Runyon, who has written a series of books about power phrases, and she always says, say what you mean what you say, don't be mean when you say it. And I think sometimes that in today's world, we do the first two things pretty well, we don't do the last one very well. We get a little mean sometimes, and so I try to be cognizant of that. So those are three questions that I would ask, and that you made it kind of tough, Stephen, because you did a good job of asking questions to start with.
Well, I very much liked your three questions. I mean, they very much added to the interview process, and the insights you shared with the audience are quite valuable. You know, Don, again, I really enjoyed this session with you. You have this remarkable background, long history. You love your field. I can tell by the answers that you're giving and just all the work that you do. And I hope that the audience will engage you in your work and read your books. I mean, they should. You've done so much, and there's a lot there.
Well, Stephen, I'm honored and humbled that you ask, and I'm very, very grateful. I'm so grateful that you gave me an opportunity to visit with you and speak, and I hope that the information has been helpful. Can I throw in a plug for my website?
Oh, absolutely. Go ahead.
What are you going to say once I ask the question, right? There's two. If you go to my speaker website, which is www.doncrawley.com, and that's about my public speaking and books, and then my training website is www.soundtraining.net.
Well, thank you for sharing those resources. Again, that will be of value to the audience.
I hope so. Thank you.
Don, with your demanding schedule, then we are really fortunate to have you come in and do this interview. And again, thank you for sharing your deep insights and experiences with our audiences.
Stephen, it's been wonderful, and it's always great to hear somebody who speaks Canadian English. I love words like schedule and process as opposed to schedule and process, the way we say it in the colonies.
Oh, you make me laugh, Don. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with the remarkable Don Crawley, acclaimed author, speaker, international authority in Linux, Cisco, and many other technologies.